For many visitors that travel to Ypres, perhaps they'll stay in the immortal city itself in one of the lovely hotels there. And then after a hearty breakfast, they'll jump on their coach or get into a car. And their journey up to Tynecot, perhaps the largest Commonwealth war graves cemetery of them all, will take them, maybe without even realising it, across the now modern roundabout that was once a crossroads known as Hellfire Corner, a location that we're going to return to soon. But then the quickest way to get to Tynecot is to take the modern road, the N37. Before you know it, you're heading up one of those low ridges, the Pilcombe Ridge on your left, and you come across the rather strange A19 motorway. You cross that, you go over it, and when you look to your left, you see that suddenly the motorway comes to a halt. Halted because they didn't want to go across the Pilcombe Ridge battlefield and disturbed the men that had died there in 1915 and 1917. It's a rather eerie sensation standing there looking down near my mousetrap farm. But that's, again, a story for another day. Our journey, we continue past that junction. And before long, we come to a crossroads. And to our left is the small hamlet of Frizenburg. Just a few buildings there. Of course, not the same buildings that would have been there prior to the Great War. They're long gone. And this road that we're travelling along, well, it wasn't a road that the soldiers of the First World War would recognise. This was a railway line. The railway that went between Ypres and a town, the railway junction, that the soldiers knew as Roulers, beyond the Passchendaele Ridge. A town which they weren't to see until the autumn of 1918. Again, a story for another day. It's that junction that I want to talk about today, the Frizenburg Ridge. And it's not the Battle of Passchendaele from 1917. We're not going to talk about that today, but we're going to talk about the Second Battle of Ypres, a battle that, whenever we talk about it, we think of the dreadful gas attack by the Germans on the French, Algerian and Moroccan troops in April of 1915, and then the heroism of the Canadians that stepped up and lost 2,000 men killed at Vancouver Corner. It's not that story. We talked about that before. But the clock moved on in that Second Battle of Ypres. The fighting, the desperate fighting, continued. New units were rushed into the line to plug the gap, to stop the Germans from getting through to Ypres as they'd tried to do in the previous winter. This was another attack. It wasn't gas that they were using in early May of 1915, although they did use gas. But on this day, we're going to talk about a group of men, territorial soldiers, weekend soldiers, Saturday night soldiers, that had arrived on the battlefield of Ypres from the valleys of South Wales. This was the 3rd Battalion of the Monmouthshires. And as I say, it wasn't gas that they were facing that day, but the massive artillery guns that the Germans had moved forward to the Brusinger Ridge near the town of Zonnebeek, along that ridge where Tynecot Cemetery now looks down across the battlefield. The Germans were about to open an enormously powerful artillery bombardment on those Welshmen, not wearing steel helmets. They hadn't yet come into use. That was still some months away. They were wearing those soft peak caps. They had with them their Lee Enfield rifle and very little else to defend them from this powerful, vengeful curtain of lead and iron that was about to come down on top of them, and not just them, but other units in the line that day. But it's the 3rd Monmouthshires that we're going to feature their story today, and what happened to them in the early days of May 1915, and in particular, the 8th of May 1915. This was killing on an industrial scale, and something that these men could not have expected or anticipated. And so many of them didn't live to tell the tale. so many of them are still there, beneath those green fields of Flanders, looking up the gently sloping ridge that leads up to Zonnebeek, where the Germans had those guns. It's peaceful there now. Nothing really happens there now apart from some farming. The crops grow silently. They refuse to tell us the secrets that they hold. But we're going to discuss those secrets today in another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And some of these tales, once again, really do stir the imagination. So who were the 3rd Battalion of the Monmouthshire Regiment? Well, they were known fondly as the 3rd Mons, and they were recruited largely from an area in Gwent Borough in South Wales, and they were called to active service in 1914 when the Great War broke out. They went into this battle almost at full strength with over 1,000 men. But when the final roll call was called, only 134 of them had survived unscathed. The rest had either been killed, wounded, or were simply missing in action. The battalion had simply been destroyed, removed from the face of the earth. It had ceased to be a fighting battalion in anything but name. So their journey began in their headquarters, small town in South Wales called Abergavenny. And when war was called, when war was declared, they mobilised. And on the 5th of August 1914, the day after they received their orders, the whole battalion gathered outside the market hall in Abergavenny at dawn. And later that day, they were marched to Bailey Park, where they were given tea. Battalion colours were handed over to the custody of the mayor and the corporation of the town. They left the market square into a rousing send-off by flag-waving citizens. And down the road, out of the town, over the bridge of the Green River and up to the railway station. 2 troop trains were ready and waiting, and the soldiers boarded them, and they were bound for Pembroke Docks. What they didn't realise was those people that waved them off, or those territorial soldiers that were heading for the docks, but for many of them it would be their final sight of South Wales and their families. They weren't immediately sent out to the Western Front. They weren't properly trained. They needed to be trained, and that was going to take some time. So they were sent here, Northampton, my hometown. They arrived here on the 30th of August 1914, and the barracks here weren't big enough to house and billet these men from South Wales. So there's a working class part of Northampton called St James's, Jimmy's Inn, we call it. And the housewives and mums that lived there were paid to look after these young Welshmen in their first experience away from home. And the Welshmen were very popular amongst the people of Northampton. And that friendship was to last for many, many decades for those that survived. The battalion set up their headquarters in the St James's Church Institute. And at the back of it were some fields that we now call Victoria Park. And they used that as their training ground. And the battalion stayed in Northampton until the end of October of 1914. So they went in here for a couple of months. But as I say, they made themselves feel extremely popular amongst the locals. The last day of October of 1914, they were on the move. They moved from Northampton to work on the East Coast defensive system, because at that time, the threat of invasion was still considered to be real enough. But then, in the middle of November, they came back to Northampton to refit for what was then planned to be service in India. That didn't happen. A few days later, they went back to the Suffolk coast, and after Christmas of 1914, found themselves in Cambridge. Their training continued. And on the 11th of February 1915, they were inspected by His Majesty King George V. And this was just 2 days before they embarked for France. And they arrived at the port of Le Havre, a long way from the battlefields. But just 3 days later, they arrived by train, 14 miles to the west of Ypres. They had their first experience of marching on what the French call pavé and we call cobblestones, this uneven road surface of stone, which caused so many blisters and problems for the BEF soldier marching in 1914. Their training continued behind the lines. And on the 6th of March 1915, we've got a man called Private James Bowles. and he wrote a letter home and gave some details of life at the front. The letter was published in the local newspaper. He said, "We do 4 days in the trenches, then come back for 4 days rest. The firing line is about 8 miles away. The other day we had our pay and we're now spending it. I and two others go down to a small farm, French woman, 8 children, husband, a captain in the French army. There we have what we can get, café au lait, bread and butter and eggs. At night we're able to get chips. Most of the houses and pubs or estaminets are wrecked and so are the churches and farms, but the people are coming back to the places they left. Nearly every farmer here has 2 or 3 Belgian refugees employed. Dirty farms compared with English ones. Sanitation is not considered here anyway. Good job it is winter and not summer. I've moved my little bed from the loft with the battered roof down to the cow shed, and I'm sleeping with a long row of cows about 3 yards from me. It is better as there is no roof over my head before. The socks will be welcome as my feet are always wet. Although my boots are good, they get sodden. For the trenches, we have rubber jack boots, so they're all right. The other night, some of our chaps, in getting to the trenches, had to climb over an obstacle. One of them was holding up his hand in the dark to be pulled up by his mate. When he grasped what he found by the touch was the hand of a chap who'd been covered up. One who had gone on. They were very plentiful, and you see different parts sticking out of the soil. The Germans, if you shoot one of them, will signal a ball with a spade and shortly afterwards will throw the body over. It acts as a sandbag and helps stop bullets. I'm longing for the time when we'll be coming back. I'm in the pink and I could eat 10 Germans, not to mention killing them. Glad to hear Ernie's all right at Pembroke Dock. I expect he'll be out here soon. Private 2155, James Bowles, 3rd Monmouthshire." What Private Bowles didn't realise was that he'd only got a few weeks to live. He may still be there somewhere. He died on the 3rd of May 1915. He's one of so many that are still missing and is remembered on the Menin Gate. That first spell in the front line was actually at Hill 60. They were connected to one of the Royal Engineers tunnelling companies and went out of the line, were billeted in the convent school in the so far relatively undestroyed city of Ypres. But a report in a battalion diary gives evidence that the scholars at the school had left in a hurry. He said, "It is of pathetic interest to recall that on entering the school, the men found the scholars' books, papers and pens lying about the desks, evidence of their hurried departure when the bombardment of the First Battle of Ypres had commenced in the autumn of 1914. Now, before the Second Battle of Ypres began, the battalion war diary is beautifully written. So often these diaries are written as almost a matter of fact, just giving military facts and decisions and orders about what had happened. But this record that I'm going to be using this week, I think was written, or it definitely was written, sometime after the war. I think it was written during the 1920s. And not only is there full accounts written with the benefit of hindsight, but the writer's been back to the battlefield and has taken a number of photos of the Fresenberg Ridge, and these areas were known to the men from Monmouthshire. And I've copied them and I'll put them on my Terry's Tours website, the podcast page. If you go to that, you'll see copies of the photographs that's in the battalion diary, and also photographs of some of the officers that we're going to be talking about today. Battalion diary tells us what it was like to move through Ypres during this period before the Second Battle of Ypres. And that's the period when the city is destroyed, really, for the first time. Of course, it had been damaged and set on fire during the First Battle of Ypres, but up until this time, there were still civilians living there. He says, "It was dark when we reached the Grand Place, what we now know as the Grote Market. The Cloth Hall and St Martin's Cathedral were wrapped in a mysterious gloom. We were conscious of a wide space filled with moving bodies of troops, but unable to discern anything clearly. But it was not time for such reflections. The order was to draw rations and go to the trenches, and the battalion moved off through the Menin Gate, up the Zonnebeek Road to Fresenberg, and then struck off half right across country to Polygon Wood in the southeast of the salient. Battalion headquarters were in dugouts in the mound now known as the Butte de Polygon, now surmounted by an Australian war memorial. So anyone that knows that area is fully aware of where these men are. Polygon Wood at this stage was still a little damaged, but he's a bit critical here of the French army that were holding these trenches before they arrived. And he says the dugouts were of French construction, not excavated many inches deep, and so affording little protection either from rifle fire or from the weather, but roofed with green pine needles and irregularly placed, so they were well hidden from the air. This was very necessary as enemy aircraft was quite active. The French had made rather an artistic job of them and had written verses on the trees. Now, as Private Bowles had told us earlier, they were only in the front line for a few days. And on the 12th of April, they were relieved and found themselves back in billets in Ypres. And he says now was an opportunity to examine this famous old city by daylight. It was seriously damaged and there was occasional shelling, but the bulk of the cloth hall still stood and was not much more ruinous than it appears in photographs taken in November of 1914. The civil population had by no means all left. Cafes did a good trade and shops were selling not only wine and cigars, but such useful articles for the trenches as refills for electric torches and solidified fuel. British troops abounded and no doubt their presence was known to the enemy, though no one was supposed to go out until after dark. It was a curious interlude in a strenuous life. One scene comes back to memory, a boxing competition between two companies in a school playground with a British band playing and overhead a German tauba. On the 15th, the battalion moved into the lunatic asylum near the Dixmude Gate, and on the 17th we went back to the trenches. Now there was a father and son that had been serving with the Monmouthshires in Polygon Wood at this stage. There was William Pritchard, who'd been a regular soldier before the war. And when war broke out, his son Reginald, who was 19, signed up. And young Reg, he wrote a letter home to his mum about what was happening there. Don't forget they'd been at Hill 60 and now they're in Polygon Wood. And this is before the Second Battle of Ypres began. He said, "It's much worse fighting where we are now to what it was in the last place. One of the chaps out of the same section as I got wounded in the leg yesterday morning as we were leaving the trenches. One man got killed in our company by a trench mortar shell. He was in the same platoon as Dad." That turned out to be his final correspondence with home, because on the 2nd of May 1915, both men were killed in action. Neither has a known grave. Both are remembered on the Minning Gate. 18 years later, I've got a photograph of the mother and wife, Mrs. Pritchard, and she's at a service in Abergavenny. She's being presented to Lord Tryon, and she's explaining how her husband and son were both killed in battle. 99 years after both men were killed, William, the father, his service medals went up for sale. It was estimated that they were going to be sold at auction for about £400. But when the story became known that his son had also died on the same day, it made the medals much more valuable and they were sold for £1,300. Nobody knows what happened to Reginald's medals. Somehow down the years they've been lost. It's a shame that the father and son's medals are not together. They were still in those bullets when news came through of the gas attack on the 22nd of April. Their billets in the lunatic asylum were targeted, shelled by the Germans. They lost some of their kit. They weren't actually there when the shells landed on their billets. Battalion diary says that they saw the retreat of the French on the north of the salient, the magnificent resistance of the Canadians, and the advance of the enemy towards Ypres, and the repeated British counterattacks which held up the advance and recovered some of the lost ground. They found themselves back up at Polygon Wood, but all around them the Germans were advancing and they were really stuck out on their own. So the decision was made to withdraw, shorten the line, and they moved back to this line approximately east of Hooge Chateau and that small hamlet of Fresenburg. That shortened their line by 5,000 yards. So I suppose you'd call it a tactical withdrawal. It's not a retreat, is it? British Army doesn't retreat. So the date is now the 1st of May 1915. They've only lost a few casualties at this stage. But a week later, all that remained of the 3rd Battalion of the Monmouthshires was 134 men. For a few days, they dug in. Not these big trenches, deep and wide, that we see in the photographs, just scrapes in the ground, I suppose. Some of the trenches were already there. They were linked up with communication trenches. But it wasn't a proper infrastructure. There wasn't time. Still, the casualties were light. What they didn't know was, about 2, maybe 3 miles away, the Germans were bringing up their artillery and focusing their sights on the thousands of BEF soldiers that were digging in the valley, a rather shallow valley in front of them. Battalion diary says, about 6 a.m. on the 3rd of May, the enemy sent forward their first patrols and began bombarding the new front line, which they'd registered some days earlier during construction. At 10:30 a.m., they were observed digging in at a distance of 400 to 700 yards away. At 5 p.m., the frontline trenches on the north and centre of our brigade front were reported as being seriously damaged. The evening of May the 4th saw the beginning of the battalion's hardest trial and greatest achievement. The strains and stress were all over within a week, but during that period, the 3rd Monmouthshires were involved in some of the hardest fighting of the war, suffered heavy casualties, and now outnumbered by the enemy and without adequate artillery support, held up the German attack at a crucial point of the line. The new front line had been hastily and poorly constructed, suffering severely from the bombardment. So bad did the conditions become that both the 2nd East Yorks and the 5th King's Own were compelled that night to dig a new line just behind the original one. Casualties had been heavy and the wounded were removed with great difficulty during the night, whilst the dead had to be buried where they fell. May the 5th opened with a still severer bombardment, and the frontline troops were reported as being in a very exhausted condition. They were taken up to their defensive positions by the commanding officer of the 2nd Battalion of the East Yorks. And with them went a man called Captain Steele. He was in C Company of the 3rd Monmouthshires, and they'd been held in reserve in what was called the GHQ line, which had been prepared not far behind where they were supposed to be defending the line. He responded immediately to this crisis. He moved eastwards towards the Ypres Rulers railway line, which is now that main road that I mentioned. And as they advanced, they came under heavy fire, but a lot worse was to follow. The situation was becoming critical on the East Yorkshire's front, so Steele had to make a decision. Don't forget, he only just arrived on the battlefield. He decided to split his company into two. Captain Gorman took half of it by way of the railway line to reinforce the right flank of the East Yorks, and he took, took the other half directly over the crest of the bridge to reach the left flank more directly. And that manoeuvre, in broad daylight, was recognised to be very dangerous, but Steele felt he had little option, because the East Yorks were suffering so badly from German fire directed at their trenches, and the enemy infantry were rapidly approaching the trenches. Captain Gorman, he succeeded, under heavy shell and machine gun fire, in reaching the front line, but he found that the garrison of 80 yards of trench, he found that they were all dead, victims of that intense shelling, and the line had been completely destroyed. As he returned to the railway cutting under his command, he was caught in machine gun fire and severely wounded. In spite of his wounds, he ordered his half company to withdraw to a line just behind the crest of the ridge, so they had some cover. And Captain Steele, that man, he succeeded in reaching the front line over the crest, but not without considerable casualties. And although now supporting the East Yorks, it was really a question of how long the position could remain tenable, how long could they hold on to it. And Steele, he was a doctor by profession, and he proceeded to tend the wounded and to tend them under what little cover there was. He even went in search of Captain Gorman. He found him lying in the railway cutting, and he was able to make him as comfortable as possible. There was no chance of getting him back to a dressing station. Captain Steele received the Military Cross for his action that day, but a Private Mitchell, he thought he should have got more. He said words utterly fail me to say what a hero Captain Steele was during that fearful struggle. From every person I meet, they tell me the same tale. Under very heavy shell and Maxim fire, he went out and fetched in wounded, bandaged them, and if he doesn't deserve a Victoria Cross, no man on earth ought to get it. He was a hero in every sense of the word, and his men absolutely worshipped him, and I would go through hell with him, for such it was that day. Shortly after this, Steele's experience as a doctor meant he was transferred to the Royal Army Medical Corps, and he ended up being promoted to Lieutenant Colonel and placed in command of a field ambulance in June of 1918. After the war, he returned to his old battalion, the 3rd, and he became the commanding officer, but he relinquished his commission in July of 1921, and he lived until March 1967, when he died at the age of 80. And he'd served in the army since 1905 until his retirement 16 years later. And now we reach May 8th, the final day of the battle as far as those Welshmen were concerned. There was a Private Badham, came from Abergavenny. He wrote afterwards, "The 8th was the day I shall never forget. They started bombarding the same time in the morning, and about half an hour afterwards we could hear a long blast of a whistle and the attack started. We were only a handful of men, and they came on in their thousands, but we kept them at bay. But I knew we would have to give way before long. The fellows on our left and right were retiring, and we had orders to do the same, but we did not go until we put some more shots into them. It was in the retirement that we lost a lot of men. They were bayoneting our wounded that we had to leave behind. Well, we got back to our second line of trenches and reinforcements came up. After that, I don't know what happened. I went to the hospital with shrapnel in my back and a big bruise on my shoulders and gas in my eyes." And to get more detail about what happened on that awful day, we turn to a primary account, once again written in the battalion diary, but several years after the battle had taken place. It's neatly typed up and it says this: "At daybreak on May the 8th, B Company came in for the shelling which the enemy poured on the whole line. They were evidently searching for a battery behind the wood, but did not neglect the wood itself and killed two officers, Lieutenant Groves and Palmer. Fortunately, other casualties were few, as the shelling was mostly directed at one portion of the wood." Now, looking at a map that I've got, they're talking about Wildwood. But when you look on Google Maps now and you travel down that road, that small wood is no longer there. It's just a field. Battalion diary goes on to tell us that their neighbouring battalion, the 1st Coilies, had suffered much from the shelling, but beat off a German attack with rifle fire. And then when a second attack began, reinforcements seemed necessary and B Company dashed across the open to the front line. A dip in the ground favoured the advance and the casualties were few, but Captain Gardner was shot through the heart as he entered the trench, a great loss. He was one of the finest looking and best soldiers in the battalion. And 2nd Lieutenant Paul was wounded at the same time. The attack in front was beaten off, and in the afternoon in the immediate neighbourhood, it proved quiet, but there was great danger of the company being surrounded. A Canadian battalion on the right were forced back to their support trench, and on the left to the north of the wood, there was a large gap and both flanks were more or less in the air. Now that's a nightmare, isn't it, for any defending troops, having both of their flanks open. It means they can be surrounded. Captain Gatty went to the headquarters of the Rifle Brigade for reinforcements to protect the exposed flanks and was able to guide them as far as the Canadian support trench, but machine gun fire prevented them from advancing further until dark. Meanwhile, a party of the Monmouthshires and the Coileys were in fact in advance of all other British troops with both flanks exposed. Our party was now completely cut off from its own brigade, so Captain Gatty proceeded to Brigade HQ for orders, leading the remains of B Company under 2nd Lieutenant Somerset. Under cover of darkness, the men of both units filed out of the right end of the trench and were sorted out, and the men in the wood were ordered to rejoin. This party had received no orders to advance in the morning and had been left behind. The senior soldier, Corporal Sketchley, had kept them together during the day and now led 30 of his men out to join the company. The enemy attacks up the railway on his left, and they'd come so near that his party had taken a prisoner, and now they brought him with them. Corporal Sketchley received the Distinguished Conduct Medal for his great initiative and pluck at this period. The enemy did not attempt to harass the withdrawal, and the whole mixed party got safely back to the Rifle Brigade HQ. After a halt, they then proceeded across the railway and intended to rejoin the brigade at Valamatingi. At GHQ line, a staff officer ordered the party to the trenches again, so just as dawn was breaking on the 9th, they turned off the road near the trench occupied on the 4th and advanced across the open fields to the front line. It was a day of inaction that tried the nerves far more than a hard day of hard fighting. Luckily, it was not a day of starvation too, for early in the morning, some foragers found a broken down water cart and bread and tinned honey dumped in the road. The casualties for the day had been enormous, and the brigade diary records as being 128 officers and 4,379 men killed, wounded and missing. The 3rd Monmouthshire's A and D companies had one officer and less than 30 men, including those on headquarters duties, and B and C companies had three officers and barely 100 men left. In this second battle of Ypres, the 3rd Monmouthshire's had lost 11 officers, two CSMs killed and 12 officers, one CSM wounded, and the actual casualties amongst the NCOs and men are difficult to state with certainty, as a great number of those killed were posted as missing. As nearly as can be estimated, 260 were killed and about 400 wounded. It is greatly to the honour of the battalion that very few other than those wounded were taken prisoner. In the evening, Lieutenant Merton Jones and CSM Morris arrived with rations and water after they'd almost walked into the German lines whilst looking for B Company. Some cavalry too arrived as a relief, and finally on the 10th, B Company reached the huts at Valamatingi, where the rest of the battalion had been for 24 hours. During all this time in the line, we were well supported from transport that had come from Ypres, come through the Menin Gate and along either the Menin Road or the Zonnebeek Road, and had to dodge the bursts of German shelling. The quartermaster's stores were at first in Ypres, but the heavy shelling at the end of April drove them out of this place, and after various moves, finally back to Poppering. And only the first line transport remained billeted in the field west of Ypres. The story of the second battle, told in a fragmentary manner, now draws to a close. On the morning of May the 10th, all that was left of the 3rd Monmouthshire's was collected at the huts at Valamatingi. They'd gone through much since April the 17th. The fighting of the last week was an experience that the whole course of the Great War could hardly surpass. Now there was time to learn and to regret our losses, but everyone at Valamatingi had cause to be thankful that he was alive and that so many of his comrades were spared. When we look at the casualty figures now, we find that in those first 11 days of May, the battalion actually lost 213 men that were killed or died of their wounds. 85 of those died on the 2nd, and 92 of them on the 8th, the worst day of all. Of the 213, 202 are still missing. They may still be there, and they're remembered on the Menin Gate Memorial. That gap in the ramparts that they would have passed through on their way up, their final journey on their way up to the front line on that spring day in 1915. So now let's look at some of the personal accounts that were written by the men that were there. A private A.L. Devereux, he wrote a letter to his family a day or two after the battle. He says that hundreds of them were put out of action with shells, and it left very few men to man the trenches. After the Huns shelled all the country for a couple of miles, stopping any reinforcements from being brought up, and thousands of the rabble charged our trenches in their favourite massed formation. The few boys that were left in our trenches showed the kind of stuff Britain can turn out, and thousands of the Germans were put out of action. It was the German Reserve Regiment number 242 that were attacking the Welshmen that day, and their official historian said this: "The effects of our heavy artillery was devastating. One shell crater ran into another. Only a few desperate survivors defended themselves obstinately." Another Welshman on the receiving end of the artillery barrage said it was awful slaughter. "It was hellish to see our chaps killed and buried and hear them shouting in agony." Private Devereux continued with his account in his letter. He said after they'd finished with our fire trench, they came on thinking they'd beaten us completely. But there was a company of men in the support trenches, and when Mr. Fritz came over the ridge, he found another trench about 500 yards away. The boys in support had had more sleep than those in the fire trench and had not been subjected to such severe shelling, and they soon showed Fritz what a rifle, when handled properly, could do. That intensive training that the Monmouthshires had done before going into the front line was now paying dividends. Private R. Jones of A Company, he wrote this: "A good many of our men were lying killed and wounded in the trenches to the left and right of where I was. I was shot in the face by a rifle bullet about 11 o'clock, when the word was passed up, 'All for yourselves!' We then commenced to retire, and four of us, Captain Baker, his orderly, the telephonist and myself, were all together in that part of the trench and immediately retired down the communication trench and got out onto the open ground at the back. I took shelter in a shell hole made by a Jack Johnson shell, and on looking out I saw Captain Baker lying on the ground a few yards away. He'd been shot, I think, in the hip or lower part of the body and was quite unable to rise. I went to his assistance and dragged him about 7 yards nearer the shell hole when he told me to look after myself. When I left Captain Barker, the Germans were only about 600 yards away and were coming on swiftly all of the time." Captain Baker died. I think as I read this, it really does dawn on me how, just as in the first Battle of Ypres a few months before, they really were holding on to Ypres by the skin of their teeth. But they did hold on. In any situation like this, there's always men that got away that had a lucky escape, and one of those was another officer, Lieutenant Gordon Bennett. The newspaper tells us that he was wounded in action, but had a miraculous escape from death. He was wounded by fragments of two shrapnel shells and lay where he fell from 11 a.m. until 7:30 p.m. It was impossible for him to move or be moved. The shells were falling all around, and there was a continual rain of rifle bullets. The severity of the fighting will be shown when it's stated that Lieutenant Bennett had 17 holes in his haversack, whilst his leggings were absolutely riddled. He has wounds in the legs, shoulder, cheek, face, and the back of his head. His injuries, however, are not serious. And when his parents, from Abertillery, saw him in hospital in London on Monday, he was cheerful and as well in health as could be expected. Now, the good news is that he definitely survived his wounds. And in 1928, Gordon married a young lady called Lucy, and he remained in the army, or he rejoined the army later on, and followed in his father's footsteps and worked for a while at the big military hospital at Netley near Southampton. And the last record I can find of him is in 1938, where he and Lucy are on a boat heading for Bombay, now Mumbai in India. I can't find any record of him after that, but at least he appears to have fully recovered from those awful wounds. But he was no doubt grateful that one of those shells or one of those bullets didn't hit him flush in the head or another part of his body and kill him. Gordon was one of those that really did have a charmed life. One of the men that was captured that day was a Corporal Lovell Jolliffe, and he was taken to Germany. But just over a year later, in October of 1916, he arrived at Great Yarmouth on the east coast of England. He arrived by boat at Great Yarmouth on the east coast of England, and the news was conveyed to his mother in a telegram from the corporal. He'd been severely wounded on the 8th of May and taken prisoner, but he'd somehow managed to escape captivity. He got a boat from the Netherlands and made it back to his family. His best mate was a Private Harvey. He was serving with the Hampshire Regiment, and he'd also escaped from a German prisoner of war camp and made it back home. I've got here another one of those personal accounts of what it was like to be there on the 8th of May. And this was written by a Private Lawrence, who was in Nottingham Military Hospital, having been wounded. He wrote this. From 3:30 at night on May the 8th, the Germans heavily bombarded the position. Opposite were the Prussian guards, who made several attempts to break through, but we held them in check until about 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, when we were ordered to get into the communication trenches. The Germans were within 50 yards of us, and as we were carrying out the movement, we had to pass two machine guns. Morgan, who comes from Tredegar, began to operate one of the guns himself, while the rest of us, who were not totally disabled, crawled back. I passed him whilst he was doing it. He was the coolest man there, although shells and bullets were pouring round. Then, when we'd passed him, he put the gun out of action and followed us. In doing so, he had to pass the second machine gun, and as the Germans were getting close, he started this on them and kept it going for 10 minutes, compelling them to keep to the shelter of a brick farmhouse. Nobody else was near him. At last, he received a bullet through the shoulder, and before crawling away, he destroyed this gun in the same way as the other one. It was a wonderful fine thing to do all this alone, and he saved lots of lives. Our boys think he ought to receive some distinction. I wonder if he ever did. I wonder who that Private Morgan was. And then there's the story of one of those young officers who was doing his best to lead his men under such exceptionally trying conditions at the tender age of just 19. He was Second Lieutenant Charles Malin Clifton Sorby. We have a couple of fine tributes to how brave this young man was that I've managed to find. The first one, from the same newspaper in South Wales, says that striking tributes to the bravery of the late Lieutenant Sorby, son of Mr. and Mrs. Sorby from Darfield Rectory in Yorkshire, are paid by his commanding officer and a wounded sergeant in his platoon. Major Bridge, commanding officer of the 3rd Monmouthshires, writes this letter to his parents. "I'm taking the earliest opportunity of writing to give you a few particulars of your son's death that I can only of necessity glean from the few men of his company left with me. He received bad wounds whilst holding with his company a trench in the first line under the most terrific shell fire. I saw him the night before, he having been sent to the headquarters dugout with a message, and although poor boy a bit shaken with the heavy concussion of shell fire, as indeed all up there must have been, he returned gallantly to his company. Although I'd not known your son long, I knew enough to realise that we've lost the most promising young officer and a brave comrade." And that sergeant was a man called Davis, and he was writing from another hospital, this time in Liverpool. And he said, "As one of Lieutenant Sorby's platoon, please accept my deepest sympathy on the loss of your son. I'm only a sergeant, but can truly say I lost the best friend I had in the regiment when I lost my officer. I know you'd like to know that he was the friend of all the men in his platoon, who simply worshipped him. He was always looking for ways to help them in the hard work they had to do, and was not above doing the share of anyone who was all done up. The day before he was wounded, I was wounded through the thigh about 6 o'clock in the morning. I lay in 2 foot of mud and water all day, waiting for stretchers. It was too light when I got hit, so I had to wait for darkness. During every hour of this day, Lieutenant Sorby performed deeds of valour for which many would have got the Victoria Cross. But he never thought of that, but kept on doing his duty. He came to me many times and asked if he could do anything for me, and just as it was getting dark, he came to say goodbye and made me promise if I got anywhere near Sheffield that I would write to you, as you would be glad to hear of him. No stretchers came for me, as they were so busy. When he came back about 5:30 a.m, he asked for 4 volunteers to carry me out. Well, he could have had a dozen if he wanted, so he picked out 4 of the strongest and got them started off. I was on a sheet of roofing on 2 long poles. We'd not gone above 30 yards when the Germans opened fire on us, and 2 of the men got shattered arms and had to drop me. I'd just about given up hope. What with the wound and the shock when dropped, I was too weak to get back to the trench, and I lay in the open with bullets dropping all around me when Lieutenant Sorby dashed out of the trench and not only dragged me back, but placed himself between me and the Germans so as to screen me from fire. He got back safe, and I can assure you it was one of the bravest deeds of the war, but he never thought of anything but of getting me back. You can guess how near death I was when I tell you that the bullet ripped my tunic whilst I was lying there and lodged in my breast pocket in some papers and books. One was Lieutenant Sorby's envelope with your name and address, and you can see where it stopped in the corner. I can assure you that though he was badly wounded, he kept asking if I was all right and never a thought for himself. It was a great shock to hear he died of his wounds, but I hope it will help you to bear your loss to know that he died like a gallant soldier and gentleman. And I say it again, this lad who's performing such bravery is just 19 years old. After reading that, I look back to when I was a similar age, 18, 19, and I do so, to be honest, with some embarrassment. I wasn't fit to lace the boots of these lads. I suppose that's one of the reasons why I like to talk about and remember and visit the graves of these lads. Charles, having been wounded, was evacuated from the trenches and he was taken across the border into France to a casualty clearing station at Balliol, and that's where he died, and that's where he's buried in the communal cemetery there. And on one of my tours to the battlefields this year, I'll be paying my respects to him, and maybe if you're going that way, you'll do so as well. Now, so far, with a couple of exceptions, the stories that I've talked about are for men that pay the ultimate sacrifice or were badly wounded. But now I want to wind the clock forward to 1969, May of 1969. So this is, what, 54 years after one of those men, Edmund Simmons, had been taken prisoner on that day at Fresenburg. And May of 1969... he was celebrating 50 years of married life. The newspaper tells us that he was married on the 12th of May 1919 at the Methodist Church in Abertillery, shortly after being discharged. And in 1969, he was 71 years old. And by the age of 13, he'd been working in the mines in the Vivian Colliery. With the advent of the First World War, the Collier Eddy became a bugler in the 3rd Monmouthshires. His fighting days were few because in the Second Battle of Ypres he was taken prisoner and held in Germany for the duration of the war. Now, his future wife was called Elizabeth Rogers, and she was working in a laundry. Well, while Eddie was at the front, she got into the laundry working as an ironer, doing ironing. Eddie returned from the war and popped the question to the girl he'd known from his childhood. She accepted, and they made their home in Abertillery. Eddie returned to the mining pits where he worked throughout his life until he retired in the early 1960s. The couple have 3 children and 7 grandchildren, and asked what had been the secret for their happy life. Give and take, according to Elizabeth. We've had our ups and downs, but it's been a good life. I wonder if Elizabeth, or his 3 children or 7 grandchildren, ever knew about what he'd experienced in that Second Battle of Ypres. I wonder if he ever talked about it or his experiences in a prisoner of war camp. But at least he lived to tell the tale, if he chose to. There's a lovely photograph of the couple celebrating their anniversary with a lovely cake. And I'll also put that on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk. So how do we remember those men from the Monmouthshires that gave their lives that day? Not on the battlefield itself, because other than the memories, and perhaps the ghosts and the wind whistling through the open ground. There's nothing there. You wouldn't know what happened there on that day. But back in Monmouthshire, in Abergavenny, that small town where most people worked in the mining community, there's a small traffic island, or roundabout as we call them in the UK, in the middle of the town by the church. And there's a concrete platform, and on top of that platform is a Tommy, a statue of a Tommy, of one of those Monmouthshire lads, with his cap badge, holding or leaning on his Lee Enfield rifle, wearing his regimental cap badge. And there's a plaque that says it commemorates on the 8th of May 1995, the 80th anniversary of the 3rd Mons Memorial Day. In the 1914-18 war, on that day in 1915, the battalion suffered heavy casualties in the Second Battle of Ypres. This monument is the work of Gilbert Ledward, OBE. He was the sculptor. As we now know, over 200 of those men from the valleys died in the fighting. Many more were captured, wounded, mauled, badly hurt. I wonder whether the people of Abergavenny, as they go about their business, look up at that statue and think of those Tommies and what they sacrificed so that we could live the life that we live today. A few weeks ago, we talked about another Welsh battalion in the First Battle of Ypres. And we ended the podcast then with a traditional Welsh song that maybe these lads sang as they went into battle. So I think in memory of those that gave their lives, and the 3rd Monmouthshire's, another Welshman in the Second Battle of Ypres, we'll do the same. The song Land of My Fathers was written midway through the 19th century by a Welshman and his son. And it's sung, or was sung, in the mines of Wales as men went to work below ground. It was sung by the Welsh battalions and regiments on the Western Front. And today it's sang proudly by Welshmen and women before Wales play rugby union. And here we're going to hear it sang by a male voice choir, Land of My Fathers.